The state Senate plans to meet for one more day, and that is tomorrow, before adjourning for the rest of the year to focus on the fall midterm elections. The Senate is expected to address school safety. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said in a statement the Senate will consider a plan that closely aligns with Governor Walker's proposals on school safety without entering special session. We're breaking it all down on this edition of the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Sean Johnson is WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. You can follow him on Twitter at SJohnsonWPR. Sean, welcome back.
Good morning.
Well, since we last talked, Governor Scott Walker has announced a $100 million school safety plan. What would it do?
I think the bulk of it is what you mentioned right there. It's $100 million for schools to make security improvements to their buildings in some way or another. It would be a grant program, so schools who want it would apply to the state, and the state would have this $100 million pot of money to pull from. There are other elements of the governor's plan. I mean, he wants to require mandatory reporting for any threats of school violence. He wants to amend the bullying statute to include prompt parental notification. So we already have a bullying law that says you need to notify parents when this occurs. This would just kind of nail down the timelines for when that has to happen. But I think far and away, when you look at the governor's school safety special session call, the biggest thing is that $100 million for school safety improvements.
The plan would also create a new office in the Wisconsin government, the Office of School Safety. What's the goal there? What would that do?
This would be the office that administers these school safety grants, really, and it would be run by the Department of Justice. So right now, that would be Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel. It would not be run by the State Department of Public Instruction, the state school superintendent, Tony Evers. So, I mean, there's a judgment call whenever you put together something like this in terms of who's going to be in charge. They went with the state's top law enforcement official there instead of the state's top education official.
The plan also includes a measure requiring schools to report any threats of violence. Isn't that already a law, or what does that have to do with it?
I think when it comes to that provision and others, it's just more like specifics in terms of when and where, how they have to report this stuff. They're, I guess, lesser elements of the package in terms of the school safety plan.
What doesn't the plan do?
I think what you notice right away when you look at this plan and, juxtapose it with what gun safety advocates have been calling for, gun control advocates have been calling for, is that it doesn't include any restrictions on firearms. And so you look at what the governor proposed, for example, and compare it to what students who marched on the Capitol a day before he proposed it called for. You know, there were 3,000 students who came to the state Capitol as part of this national, walkout to draw awareness to gun laws. So Wisconsin student walkout was calling for universal background checks on firearm purchases, banning bump stocks. Those, let somebody fire off a large number of rounds. These were used in the Las Vegas shooting. Raising the minimum age to purchase a firearm from 18 to 21. Those are some of the big proposals that they were calling for, and they in some way limit access to firearms. Those are not included in the governor's call in any way. He's really completely focused on this school safety provision.
So how likely are these bills to go through tomorrow?
So, I mean, when you look at it, if you take a step back and look at this, this is something, the idea of spending more money on school safety is something that Democrats and Republicans have both talked about. Democrats actually passed a law when they were in charge of state government that would let local school districts make these improvements on their own and go to local property taxpayers to pay for it. It would let them exceed revenue limits to do it. Governor Walker repealed that law, but that's just an example to show that Democrats have been in a similar place before. State Superintendent Tony Evers, one of the Democratic candidates for governor, is calling for something similar again this year, where property taxpayers would pay for it initially and they would be supported after that by state taxpayer dollars. So big picture, this is an idea that has bipartisan support. But Democrats are saying this time around that just proposing that without anything else you know, any kind of restrictions on firearms is missing the big picture on the governor's part.
We're talking about the school safety plan proposed by Governor Walker, $100 million plan. Breaking it down here on the State Capitol Report, Sean Johnson is with us, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with Governor Walker's school safety plan? Do you think Wisconsin should have tighter gun control measures? Do you think the state legislature should spend money on building new prisons now to house Lincoln Hills inmates after the facility closes? These are up for conversation here. 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Sean, how have schools reacted to this safety plan?
So the reactions from at least, you know, one prominent school group to this plan after it was announced was kind of twofold. One, they said, we support this. The Wisconsin Association of School Boards came out and said, you know, we support the governor's plan. But then I think the next reaction was their reaction to Republican legislative leaders and what they were saying about this proposal. So you ask, you know, like, what are the chances of this happening? And the thing is that what Republican leaders said about this pretty soon after the governor introduced it kind of called that into question. So Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, the Assembly's top Republican, came out and said, our chamber's plan is to take up the legislation on the floor of the Assembly next week in a one-day special session, basically giving the governor what he wants there.
Mm-hmm.
Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, the Senate's top Republican, said, we are working on legislation that we plan to pass in regular session next week. That's a pretty significant procedural detail there. And he also said, our proposal will closely align with the governor's. And this is where we probably need to remind people that closely align when it comes to bills becoming law is not good enough. I mean, the Senate and the Assembly have to pass the exact same version of any of these bills and for them to become law. If there's one change in one of them, it's not going to happen. So Fitzgerald coming out and saying, not only are we not going to do it in this special session that the governor's calling, but we're going to pass something that's a little bit different, that definitely calls the whole thing into, you know, puts it in doubt. And so Wisconsin Association of School Boards, at least, was saying, hang on, that could be trouble.
What are the optics at play here? Should Governor Walker and Republicans be concerned that not addressing gun control or not making inroads here could impact the midterms?
It feels at this moment like the issue of the day. I mean, it's certainly one thing that we're all talking about on a pretty regular basis since the Florida school shooting. And it's a big enough issue of the day that, you know, the governor has chosen to address this or at least call for a substantial, you know, investment in school safety when he knows that legislators are basically done and not, kind of at odds, too. I mean, he's throwing this out there as that's happening. So he knows, I think he's aware of the optics, or else he wouldn't be talking about something like this. The issue that they could run into is that they could all pass something. You know, the governor could propose something, the Assembly could pass something, the Senate could pass something. It could all be different. Nothing could become law. And they could all go home and say, well, we did something without any actual changes happening.
Well, Florida is facing a lawsuit from the NRA after its passage of legislation that, among other things, raises the minimum age to buy a gun from 18 to 21. The NRA is arguing that the law is unconstitutional. Do you get any sense that Wisconsin Republicans are concerned that they would perhaps face some backlash from the NRA if they were to pass some of this gun control legislation?
We know that there's just has not been a willingness among Wisconsin Republicans, and not just this year, but consistently, to restrict access to firearms. I mean, if anything, since Republicans took control of state government, the state has gone the other way. And it's easier to purchase a firearm. It's easy to carry a firearm. I mean, that's been the clear direction in Wisconsin government under Republican control.
Governor Scott Walker toured schools in Thorpe, Cashton, and Hartford on Friday to talk about funding for rural school districts. The bill signed into law a week ago helps low-population school districts by modifying the sparsity aid program for school districts. It is one topic of discussion on this edition of the State Capitol Report, and you can join in with your questions, developments at the State Capitol. As the last day of the Senate floor session is tomorrow, 800-642-1234. Do you think the state legislature should spend money on building new prisons now to house Lincoln Hills inmates after the facility closes? Or do you think more research needs to be done? Do you approve of Governor Walker's child tax rebate? Do you live in a rural community? Do you agree or disagree with the Senate's decision not to vote on the governor's rural economic investment plan? Call in 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation after a news update. The Senate is considering legislation to give Kimberly Clark tax credits in exchange for keeping jobs in the state. And tomorrow is that final day for the Senate to take up this legislation before it adjourns for the year. We're talking about it on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson stays with us for this preview of tomorrow's final day of regular session for the State Senate. Your thoughts and what bill is the most important to you at 800-642-1234. With the session winding down, where does that leave the future of Lincoln Hills? And what about a roadmap for juvenile justice reform? What do you think should be the next step? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Sean, let's talk about the troubled youth prison, Lincoln Hills. Where does the Senate go tomorrow with that?
We don't know for sure. We know that a Senate committee last week passed a version of the bill that was different than the one that passed the State Assembly on a unanimous vote. So the Assembly's version would close Lincoln Hills, and it would replace Lincoln Hills with a mix of state and county-run institutions. New state-run institutions, we're not sure how many, but they would be in charge of more violent youth offenders, more serious youth offenders. County-run institutions for others, and the idea would be that they would be spread out throughout the state so that these youth would be closer to their home communities and their families and would be less inclined to get out of prison and reoffend. So that the Assembly version included those and included funding for these smaller state and county-run institutions. I think the Senate version, the biggest difference that you saw right away is that those smaller state and county-run institutions would be gone. It's not to say that they wouldn't come at a later point if, you know, the Senate plan moved ahead, but they're not included in the Senate bill, and neither is the funding for the state and county run institutions. So the Senate bill would close Lincoln Hills, but it's a little less clear what would replace it.
So a completely different vision than what the Assembly is proposing for that structure around juvenile justice.
Yes, and not necessarily a different vision, but they're not going as far as the Assembly. Mm. They're not spending as much as the Assembly either when they're talking about doing this. And the thing that you heard from senators was, well, we had some members who were uncomfortable with the Assembly plan. We're not ready to kind of go that far with all the questions that it raises. You heard Democrats on the Senate committee where this proposal passed saying, look, if you do this, you are killing the bill. That was the message that you heard from Milwaukee Democratic Senator Lena Taylor. She told Senate Republicans that by changing the plan, they were killing the bill.
The GOP in the Senate will do what they do, but I want you to know that blood is on your hands in the Senate. Because this is not acceptable. It is not acceptable to do this. It's not acceptable to pass the buck. And it's not acceptable to gut it.
So pretty powerful words there from a Democratic lawmaker. What about from Republicans?
So what you heard from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss last week, was the Assembly is done, that they are not coming back. And that's why Lena Taylor there is saying that if the Senate does this, this thing's not happening. But, you know, Senator Van Wongard, Racine Republican, said that if the Assembly does that, you know, then it's kind of on them. He said, you know, that's not necessarily that they're killing this bill as long as Assembly lawmakers come back to pass the Senate's changes.
Then it'll be on the Assembly, that the Assembly failed to come back. Because there's other pieces of legislation that are major pieces of legislation that they did over there without input from the Senate. And it's 8 months until Election Day.
12-15 is because that's...
So that means that we have 8 months that we can finish it. They can't come back for one day.
So he's really looking at timeline here.
He is. Well, I mean, I think they're both. We mentioned the, you know, the kind of game of legislative chicken that's being played here. And I think what you heard Van Wongard say there could be applied to a number of the bills that are up in the Senate this week, where the Senate's going to make changes. The Assembly's already said they're done for the year. So they're both looking at each other saying, you know, who's going to flinch. And I don't know how that's going to resolve itself. It could be that it won't resolve itself and that this, you know, conflict between the Senate and Assembly's top Republicans will mean a lot of these bills won't happen.
So let's look then. What are some possible things that might happen in the off chance that the Senate bill does go through, or if it ends up being in gridlock? What happens
if the Senate bill were to happen? It would still create this a study committee with a lot of stakeholders and, you know, people who know the criminal justice system from various angles. They would still study what to do after Lincoln Hills, but their recommendations would carry less weight. And in any case, whatever they recommended would have to essentially wait until the next budget to decide whether it was going to happen. You know, legislators would have to debate this thing starting in 2019 to decide what's really going to happen post Lincoln Hills. And, you know, the youth prison would continue to operate as this debate continued.
Would continue to operate indefinitely?
It's there until there's something to replace it. One thing that Van Wongard did float the possibility of was that the governor, if the Assembly and the Senate can't come to an agreement here, that the governor could step in with some, you know, executive authority and start to move people out of Lincoln Hills potentially. I mean, you could hear Wongard, Senator Wongard, thinking this thing out as he talked about the what ifs. And that was one possibility that he raised, was that if they don't agree, which is a real possibility, that maybe the governor could step in and do something.
Well, let's look at Governor Walker's proposals to pass this $100 per child one-time tax rebate and then this one-time $50 million sales tax holiday for consumers. What do we know about the future of these bills?
These are both key pieces of the governor's 2018 agenda that he really introduced this year in the year of his reelection campaign. The tax cuts for the child tax credit seems potentially in jeopardy, because what happened is Senate Republicans didn't like another provision that Assembly Republicans added to that to create the sales tax holiday. So they took this bill, stripped out the sales tax holiday, and they're going to it looks like they're going to pass the child tax credit, but it's not going to matter, because if it's not the exact same bill, it's not going to happen. Again, this is a situation where they're all Republicans. They could come together and reach some kind of a deal. You know, it's not over. But this is the track that they're headed on, is that nothing happens there. And in the rural initiative, which passed the Assembly 95-0, by the way, $50 million for initiatives like low-interest loans to dairies and new scholarship programs for students who take ag classes at state ag colleges. That is not on the Senate calendar for tomorrow. But
something that is on the Senate calendar is Kimberly Clark. Can you tell us what are the broad strokes of what's happening there with Kimberly Clark?
Yes, this is like a Foxconn-style incentive package for Kimberly Clark is how we've referred to it. It gives Kimberly Clark state dollars for jobs that they retain at two plants that they're talking about closing in Northeast Wisconsin. There's some pushback from conservative groups who don't like this. They feel like it's a bailout and a slippery slope. But at least as of right now, it's on the Senate calendar. And typically when something's on the Senate calendar, it means that the majority party, Republicans, are going to pass it.
Do we have any idea how likely the bill will be able to pass or not?
If it's there, I think it's a signal that they think they're going to do it. Mm. That's not to say that on the day of the Senate debate, they could sort of nonchalantly say, we're going to send that back to committee. It happens sometimes. And, they don't make a big deal out of it, but it does happen.
Well, Sean, thanks as always for joining us.
You are welcome.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. You can follow him on Twitter at SJohnsonWPR. As the State Capitol Report continues, we're going to explore the crowded Democratic field. It's the most crowded statewide primary in at least a generation. Mordecai Lee is sifting through the names headed into the primary. He is a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. Mordecai, welcome back to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, there are 9 notable candidates in the Democratic field for governor, and actually, in all, it's more than 9 when you include everyone, perhaps 17 in all, if we have a running total correct. Can we run through the most notable candidates, first of all?
Well, the problem with running through the most notable candidates is that we're sort of delegating the other candidates a kind of a second-tier status. And that really gets to the heart of the issue, and that's, is it possible for voters to give a decent and fair judgment about, let's say, a baker's dozen worth of candidates? But you're certainly right that some of them are wholly unknown, some of them are partly unknown, and a few of them are relatively known, which in politics gives the familiarity gauge a real advantage. In other words, when somebody looks at a ballot of 13 names, they say, oh, I recognize that name. That's a real advantage in politics.
So do any of these candidates present a real threat to Governor Walker, or is that hard to say?
Well, generally speaking, politics is the opposite of a vacuum. In other words, when there are opportunities, then there's a lot of candidates. When there appear to be no opportunities or less opportunities, there are fewer candidates. And so it seems to me that we need to sort of judge this backwards. If there are a baker's dozen worth of candidates running, that must mean that there's some kind of amorphous public opinion that Scott Walker could possibly be beaten or could be in a relatively tight race for reelection.
We've also heard from some, pretty high-profile Democratic upsets in Alabama, Pennsylvania, both of them in districts that that President Trump won. So is that any indication of why the field might be so large?
I really think you've put your finger on it. This amorphous sense of public opinion is that the left is mobilized and the right is sort of disillusioned. This is the mirror image of after Obama got elected and sort of the left was happy and sort of went home and the right was really mobilized. And that's what led to the Tea Party. That's what led to the Democratic Party's defeats 2 years later in the midterm elections. So, yes, there are certain cycles of who's excited and who's not, and that may well be playing into this.
Well, and some of these contenders have been in the race for a while, since like last summer. How are they feeling? Do we have any indication how they might be feeling right now? Like Milwaukee businessman Andy Gronick, who has been in the race since July.
You know, it's so hard to judge because politicians are sometimes the worst at having sort of detached judgment. You know, they think, oh, I'm going to win in a landslide. I don't have to worry about money. On the other hand, there are some politicians who are very, very pragmatic in being able to step aside from what they want the world to be able to see how the world is. And so, Kate, I think what might be going on, whether we're talking about that candidate or any others, is if they really realistically say to themselves, I'm a realistic candidate, I can raise a realistic amount of money, I've got a realistic base of such and such a socioeconomic background, and I'm going to stay in the race. And we're in a state of very open politics, and anybody who can get the couple thousand signatures to get on the ballot can be a candidate for governor. So there aren't very many barriers to entry, and I think we will end up with probably 8 to 10 candidates on the ballot.
Well, if we take any measure from the Marquette University Law School poll earlier this month, State Schools Superintendent Tony Evers remains the best known of the challengers to Governor Scott Walker. What are your insights on Evers right now?
Well, name recognition is a wonderful way to start a campaign. In other words, in part this reflects that he has won statewide elections. He is a statewide office holder, and so people know who he is. They've voted for him, or they may have voted against him. And so he starts off in a relatively good position of high name recognition. The thing about name recognition is that it only takes about $2 million to change that. Now, I'm sort of put $2 million in something of a quotation mark, but in the sense of if there's any of those other candidates who will be willing to spend $2 million to introduce themselves through TV advertising to the public, they will then become as well known. They will then have the same name recognition as the superintendent, perhaps even better name recognition. And there are situations sometimes when relatively unknown candidates just sort of catch on. And so, you know, if you had a choice to be Tony Evers or not be Tony Evers, right now it's an advantage to be him. But that isn't necessarily something that's built into some kind of dried cement that's unchangeable. I think it's very changeable.
So should we read anything into some candidates being excluded from some forums earlier this month and earlier in the year?
Now, this is a really tough thing for civic organizations who want to do good, who want to give opportunities for the public at large to look over these candidates. It's like in the last presidential race when there were so many Republicans running, then the question became, well, what's the maximum you'd put on a platform, on a candidate forum? Would it be 10? Would it be 11? Would you have a kind of a secondary debate for the other people, you know, the 5 or 6 or 7? This is hard to do because we're in a situation where there aren't any sort of objective gauges about who should be given the chance and who should not be given the chance. You know, for example, sometimes you might have judgments based on level of name recognition. Is it 5% or above? Well, that's not very many of this row of candidates. Would you say, well, have they raised $500,000 or more, making them a serious candidate? Well, you could do that, but then the problem is just because somebody hasn't raised $500,000 doesn't necessarily mean they don't have a good chance to appeal to the public. So these are very tough to do. I think we ought to give a pat on the back to all the civic organizations who are trying to contribute to public awareness of the candidates, but I really don't envy them for the kind of judgments you mentioned, Kate.
Well, yeah, I mean, some practical considerations too, Mordecai, like do we have enough microphones? Do we have enough risers to fit all these people on?
You know, Kate, once I was the moderator of a campaign for Congress here in Milwaukee, and there were about 10 candidates running in a Democratic primary. And as the moderator, I, of course, wanted it to be a useful event for the public at large. I wanted to give all the candidates equal opportunities to have their say. But so anytime a member of the public in the audience stood up and asked a question, then I would say all the candidates get a chance to answer the question, even if it wasn't addressed to them. But the problem with when you have, say, 8 to 10 candidates is I had to hold them to one-minute answers.
Mm.
Because if I gave them, let's say, 2 minutes or 3 minutes, that would have meant that the whole forum might have been a total of 3 or 4 questions, and I wanted everybody to get a chance to ask a question. So that really is the practical effect of having, like you say, squeezing so many people onto a podium.
We're talking about the wide-open Democratic field with Mordecai Lee. He is a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker. You can join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Do you plan on voting for a Democratic candidate for governor this year? Are you going to vote in the August 14th Democratic governor's race primary? If so, who do you plan on voting for? Let's discuss after a news update. We're exploring the wide-open Democratic field for governor on this edition of the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the Marquette poll that came out earlier this month, the respondents were asked questions about the partisan primary leanings. It was State Schools Superintendent Tony Evers who received 18% of the vote, with no other candidate reaching 10%. Madison Mayor Paul Soglin received 9%, while former Democratic State Chair Matt Flynn rounded out the top three with 7%. Mordecai Lee stays with us to get up to speed on the field and how the candidates are differentiating themselves. Mordecai is a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker. Your thoughts on the Democratic primary at 800-642-1234. Do you plan on voting for a Democratic candidate for governor this year? Are you going to vote in the August 14th Democratic governor's race primary? If so, whom do you plan on voting for? And if you're not sure who to vote for, which Democratic candidate piques your interest? 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Jeff now, joining us from Milwaukee. Good morning, Jeff.
Hello, Mordecai. Yes, I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I'm ready to move independent, and that's because of the way the direction the Democratic Party has taken nationally and in Wisconsin. The only candidate that I'm interested in is Paul Soglin of Madison. I think what the Democratic Party needs to do is a hard turn to the left. I was a Bernie supporter, and again, a lifelong Democrat, but I want to see the party return to its roots, hard left. If they want my vote, Paul Soglin's my guy. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks so much for the call. Mordecai, what do you read into that?
Well, it's a fabulous call because he's made up his mind. He has a candidate in mind. And he's identified that candidate with a certain sort of silo of the Democratic Party, the Bernie Sanders wing of the party versus, I guess we'd say, a more moderate, maybe we'd call it the Clinton wing of the party. And so to a certain extent, there's going to be a kind of a sub-primary in each of those categories. In other words, Paul Soglin and sort of fill in the blank are contending for the Bernie Sanders vote, and fill in the blank for the others are vaguely the more moderate wing of the party. I think those two sub-primaries are going to shake out some candidates, although nobody can be forced to drop out of the race, which leads to the scenario that if there are, let's say, 10 people on the ballot, the person who wins the primary might win the primary with, gosh, 15% of the vote, 20% of the vote. It would be a very sort of undemocratic result, but that's how partisan primaries are structured in Wisconsin.
Republican Party of Wisconsin Communications Director Alex Zimmerman called it a clown car primary. So what does this historically crowded field tell us about how Democrats are doing right now in Wisconsin?
Well, this is the opposite of what happened 4 years ago when Mary Burke was sort of invisibly endorsed as the candidate because she fit a certain profile. She wasn't a current elected official. She was a successful businesswoman, that it was thought that this was a good package to run against Paul, to run against the governor. Now, in a sense, it's the opposite. It's like anybody can run. Lightning can touch anyone. Who knows who will win? And what I hope is that the field will shake out a little bit. Even if there are 10 names on the ballot, that it might turn out that there are only, let's say, four or five who are really serious candidates. And then I think it makes it slightly easier for the voters to concentrate on those.
Well, I know you have to run to teach a class, but do you get any sense that the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, well, hasn't endorsed a candidate yet, but any hunch about who they may eventually choose to endorse?
You know, I don't think they'll do endorsements. Wasn't it Will Rogers who had the quip, "I don't belong to an organized political party, I'm a Democrat"? And I think this is a perfect example of that. There are no locked doors to get in, and we'll really have to leave it up to the voters.
Well, Mordecai, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kate.
Mordecai Lee is a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker. We've been talking about the wide-open Democratic field for governor. Now that we've heard about this large field of contenders in the Democratic Party, let's open it up to you, 800-642-1234. It is time for a sound off. What's the most important issue for you as you decide whom to vote for in the race for Wisconsin governor and why? What issue or issues do you think candidates aren't talking about enough? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's lead off with Steve in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. Yes. I'm speaking as a Madison liberal, and I hope that the Democrats do not choose anybody from Madison or Milwaukee. One of the problems with what's been going on is that the Democrats do have to reach out to other parts of the state. And, you know, a Democrat, Dane County is a shoo-in for any Democrat.
So, Steve, who should they turn to then?
I like Catherine Beinhardt. All things being equal, I would go with her.
Thank you, Steve. Let's go to another Steve in Lake Mills. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. I, too, support Catherine Beinhardt. She is a senator. She beat a Republican in her district near Alma. That's in northwestern Wisconsin. She is a three-time winner in that district, and it was Republican prior to her winning, and she always puts out an alternative budget. Kathleen Beinhardt is a superb candidate.
What about the issues? What about the issues that you see on her platform?
Well, as I mentioned, she puts out an alternative budget to Governor Walker, which is sound fiscal politics. I think she's right on the whole gun control issue. She supports schools and supporting our public schools and, you know, the university system, as well as she has a PhD in, you know, in the healthcare field. So she really understands what's going on with people in the state, from healthcare to public education to an alternative budget, and she's a solid candidate.
Steve, thanks so much for contributing. Mark now in Eau Claire. Mark, you're on.
Hello. I like Andy Gronick a lot. Like Steve just said, I was early enamored with Kathleen Beinhardt. She's a superwoman, a super candidate. I don't know if she can get the nomination and then go on to beat Governor Walker. But Andy Gronick is full of great ideas, practical ideas. Many of the candidates in the forums that I have been to have similar ideas and similar positions. But I think he's got the energy and the know-how and the practicality to emerge. And he doesn't have a kind of a political coattail, you know.
Well, yeah, what do you make of his business background, Mark?
I think that's great. You know, he's kind of like the anti-Trump, because he's got this business background, yet not a lot of things they can pin on him as far as the election goes.
Well, Mark, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to another Mark now in Mineral Point. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, good morning. I think that one of the main things we need now is someone who really knows about the corrupting influence of big money interests in politics, which creates corruption, and we need to fight back against that. One candidate who is a total expert on this is Mike McCabe. He spent most of his adult life fighting corruption politics from the outside, and now he's running for governor. I think he's also one of the best, most articulate candidates in the field. And he actually has a rural background. He grew up on a farm in north central Wisconsin. And I think that he is the one candidate who can really push back against the corrupting influence of the Koch brothers and the Walker administration.
Mark, thanks so much for the call. You can sound off at 800-642-1234. What about the Democratic primary? Whom would you vote for? What issues matter to you? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Fran now in Menominee. Hi, Fran.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Calling in regards to the issue more so than the particular candidate, Wisconsin has one of its largest budget items is the penal system in Wisconsin. we're requesting now a $350 million new prison. I don't dispute that the prisons are overflowing, but when we look at the people in the prisons, we are dealing unduly harshly with activities that ought more properly be dealt with in some sort of a rehabilitative sort of sense. In addition to the new prison, where governor is requesting, the legislature is proposing, I don't know, 85 new prosecutors. Well, pretty simple. You put more prosecutors in office, you're going to have more people being prosecuted.
Do you want a governor who acts decisively on Lincoln Hills, perhaps, the troubled youth prison?
I'm sorry, the what?
Are you interested in what a governor might do with Lincoln Hills, the situation at Lincoln Hills, the troubled youth prison?
Not so much that.
Uh-huh.
That's not going to go away. We're just going to build something new and fancy that's going to be more like a prison for the youth. That's kind of a foregone conclusion, I'm afraid. Instead of helping, we'll lock them up some more.
Well, Fran, thank you so much for the call. We have Wade on Facebook who says, healthcare, income inequality, and the Citizens United decision are Wade's big issues. Paul on Facebook says, one thing and one thing only, represent the people, not the party you are aligned with. Mary on Facebook saying, gerrymandering, voter suppression, and attacks on the environment are important issues for her. Jill is saying that restoring truth and integrity is the most important issue for her. Do that, she says, and everything else falls into place. Thank you so much for contributing to this Sound Off. And as we explore this wide open Democratic field, and earlier in the hour, we talked with Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, and Mordecai Lee, a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. This edition of the State Capitol Report was produced by Colleen Leahy and Michelle Johnson. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Stay with us.